Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo, Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, October 3rd, 2011. I am Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And remember that our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com.
You're going to hear Vicky's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include my update, actually, as a patient, as a doctor's experience of working through the medical system with a tough medical problem. You'll enjoy listening to that because of the honesty and the challenges I face.
And acid-reducing drugs seem to triple the risk of life-threatening C. difficile.
And doctors admit patients get too much aggressive treatment. We'll be talking about that a lot because of what's happening to me.
And what vitamin is tied to brain atrophy and cognitive impairment? And 89% of women believe that mammograms are vital, and much, much more. Plus, if you want to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your own health, give us a call. And Prescriptions for Health at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Well, you know, things have changed quite a bit since last week's show regarding our doctor as a patient. And
Boy, am I learning a lot.
Last week, we thought we were getting close to a diagnosis, and we were excited with the team of doctors that were involved. And let's talk about how this all changed, and how was your confidence shaken?
Well, see, the problem is I had a hip surgery about a year ago, just a brief little follow-up here, for osteoarthritis. And we did a nice new procedure that put in a Birmingham hip, which is just a resurfacing. And that was a state-of-the-art thing, and things should have been wonderful, but they weren't. And a few weeks ago, I started having a pain, and I haven't been able to walk since. Now, I've been to my orthopedist who did the surgery, and he thinks that what we need to do is take that old hip out, probably, almost certainly, and go ahead and put a new one in that's a little bit different. In the meantime, what we found out is that I have something called metallosis, which if you read the New York Times, you know, came out in an article yesterday saying that what happens is these titanium implants, which should be so good, are coated with cobalt and with chromium. That's not so good, because if they don't sit perfectly in the joint, what happens is it wears off, and it goes into the local tissues where it destroys the muscles and the ligaments and the nerves and everything that's in the area. And in part, that's what's happening to me.
And, you know, they've known this since the beginning of last year.
At least
year.
A year, yeah.
Well, the beginning, more than a year, because you had your surgery last year in October.
Yeah, well, they knew that.
And by then, they'd had about 5,000 cases of this. And so your cobalt levels are very toxic. And so basically what's happening is that you're getting poisoned.
Now the story thickens. You would think that it would be fine to have a little dialogue with my doctor, my doctors, because I have
two
orthopedists, one local.
Yeah, last week you were pretty excited about all your healing circle of doctors.
You're right. I have one local one here at Walnut Creek that looks like it's not going to work out with. I have an infectious disease specialist out here that it looks like it's not going to work out with. I have my original surgeon from San Francisco, who I'm doing great with. I think chances are I'm going to go back there and have something done to make this thing come to completion.
But I think we need to educate people a little bit more
about
the story and what's going on. Because you as a doctor, you know, the doctors, I think they are a little bit...
They get intimidated.
Yeah, by you and because you are a doctor and what you know, and you don't exactly have a small mouth.
No, I don't. Well, I said what I think, and I think that everybody should say what they think.
But they're used to being the authority and having people just do what they tell them. And I'm telling you, when I went with you to these doctor appointments, they're charming, they're convincing, and they really believe their way is the way to go.
Yeah.
And when you bring up something different and try to say, well, you're an individual and your situation situation is a little bit different and so on and so forth. They don't want a part of that. But see, the other thing is that if you did decide to go with them, do you really want somebody to operate on you that might be a little intimidated by you, or right, that might be a little bit, you know, defensive with you?
No, I just want the perfect doctor, Vicki. That's the perfect doctor. One that will listen to you.
One like
and
you.
And work like a teacher, okay, because a doctor is a teacher who's willing to
but
discuss differences of opinion.
But they do seem that way. They feel like that,
yeah, but
when
they
you
aren't
go
that
see
way.
Them.
They aren't that way, because when I try to get them together for a little crossfire because they have different recommendations of what should be done, none of them want any part of it. It's sort of like it's like getting the plague.
Well, one of them said he would.
He would, but he wasn't happy about it. He said he would, and I credit him for that. But he's the one that's the most adamant about how things should be done. It seems like the orthopedists out here, okay, that are local, are more concerned about infection. And an infected hip is a big deal. I have to agree with that. I think there's no doubt that that's a big deal.
So they're not convinced that the tests that they did on you that came back that you didn't have an infection are accurate enough. They want to keep going back and doing some more aspirations.
They've
that's
already
when you stick
made
a
up
needle
their
in
mind.
And pull it out.
They've made up their mind. They're no longer willing to look at the data, and they're making the assumption that this is infection until proven something different, and they're willing to ask me to do many different kinds of tests to find out if there's infection there.
And
which
that are
I've
invasive
done.
Invasive tests. Well, they want you to do more. They even were talking about putting you under a general anesthetic to go in with an arthroscopy and biopsy a part of the bone in the area.
Yeah, the synovial membrane to see if it's infected. That's right. And I understand that, because, listen, if there's an infection there, you take out the old device and you put in a new one, and it infects where the device goes into the head of the femur, or the shaft of the femur, and it gets infected, you've got a major problem, because that thing will hardly ever heal right, and it's going to take
go
probably
right down
years
into the shaft of your
right
bone.
Down into the bone. So I respect that.
Okay, now, the other thing that I think that most people are not aware of is that antibiotics can affect your kidneys. Now, normally we think of antibiotics affecting the flora in your gut, you know, and they can give people diarrhea and they kill all the good bacteria along with the bad. And we've talked about that many times, uh-huh, but we haven't really addressed the issue about the kidneys, because what's going on with you right now, while you're being poisoned, it's affected your kidneys, mm-hmm, and your kidneys are going about half mast right now.
Right.
And this is one of the big issues with taking these powerful antibiotics for a possible infection. And they could, finish off your kidneys.
They could finish off a lot of things. I mean, kidneys are just one part of it.
So I think people, need to know more about what antibiotics can do, because people have been used to popping antibiotics like candy, which is one of the reasons why we have so many antibiotic-resistant infections.
Mm-hmm. Well, here we are with a situation where we don't know that there's infection, but we have no evidence that there is infection, because we've done a white cell count, which is normal, and it doesn't show any kinds of cells in it that suggest there's infection. We have an aspirate, okay, of the joint fluid that shows no sign of infection. We have a white blood cell scan, which identifies infection. It's a radioactive test that goes right to where the infection is. It's totally negative. And we did two blood cultures that showed no sign of infection. So now what the surgeons out here want to do, because I think they're, I would use the word paranoid, okay, about infection. And it's not like I'm not a little paranoid, too. I am, and I respect their concerns. But they want me to take a toxic antibiotic that can do a lot of bad things to me for 6 weeks prior to surgery.
Okay,
and they don't know what the microbe is, and they don't know what the sensitivities are of that microbe. So they have no idea on earth of how this toxic antibiotic will work in my body. And to make matters worse, they're making it really tough, because what they'd like to do is take out the old device and put in what's called a spacer, which means a temporary device that's impregnated with antibiotics, and leave it there for about 8 weeks until doing the final surgery. And for the 6 weeks after doing putting in the spacer, they want me to be on this powerful antibiotic that can do things like kidney damage. It causes muscle necrosis, like all the statins can do, that can poison your kidneys. It can cause eosinophilic pneumonias that require steroids for treatment. It can cause peripheral neuropathies. It can cause C. diff enterocolitis. And it has a wide range of symptoms that are hardly discussed because you're supposed to be able to handle the nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, headaches, and whatever else that you get that might be associated with them.
But
so this is not a benign, simple, safe thing to do. It comes at a price.
And what I want people to learn from this, from listening to your story, is that when you go to the doctor, like we went to the infectious disease doctor, and he talked like this antibiotic was not a problem, you didn't need to worry about it. Mm-hmm. If you had a side effect, that it would get better as soon as you stopped it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very convincing. But we came home and did a Google on
yeah,
it,
of course.
And it scared us out of our minds.
Uh-huh.
And this is where I think doctors have a lot of trouble with patients that are educated and patients who do their own research.
It. Because the advice I was given is, look, leave the driving to us. We're the doctors. We'd appreciate it that you not act like a VIP and not get engaged in any of the decisions that are made, and let us make them for you, because that's what we expect of our patient. Of course, that answer was, what, are you crazy? You don't want any of my good input? You're not interested in the fact that it's not a hip you're treating? It's a person who has a hip problem, who happens to know a lot about medicine after 40 years of practice, that just might teach you a couple things about what's possible?
But there,
why wouldn't you want to listen to someone like that?
Because it's their department, and it's their specialty.
Now, that's not scientific.
No.
It's not logical. It's not reasonable.
None of it is. So the whole thing is kind of scary.
It takes time, which they don't want to spend, and it takes effort that they don't want to commit to. And it also takes being sure that what you're saying is right and not open to question. So when I offer the possibility of all the doctors meeting together on a Skype phone call or just a regular phone call, which I'm happy to set up, nobody wants to do it. They want to keep their little domains as they are. Now, I'm having trouble taking care of myself with the background that I have. How would you listeners out there do if you tried to engage in participating in your health care? Would you have a doctor that would be willing to listen to you for more than 30 seconds before interrupting you? Could you actually get 5 or 10 minutes where you could present your case and your concerns, and then have someone come back and answer those things in a way that makes sense to you so you can feel comfortable about going through whatever it is that you need to go through?
Well, particularly when they're good-looking and they're charming and they sound very authoritative and they're very smooth, and it's like, you know, whatever you want. You're the expert. I'll just do whatever you say. And you're scared, you know.
Yeah, well,
but you had to do this before, which we've talked about on the air, but I'm just going to briefly bring it up, that you had to do this on the other end when you had complications from your spinal anesthetic. But you were extremely sick and having to run your own care.
I had a blood pressure of 60 systolic and a heart rate of 60, which means there was hardly enough blood going around my body to circulate any organ system, including the brain. And yet I was still the one with you that was able to figure out what was going on, make the diagnosis, and tell the staff that they needed to transfer me from the orthopedics floor over to CCU so that we could deal with this thing in a more effective way.
And it was really something, because you were so sick,
mm-hmm,
and having to do this to get them to do it. And right now, you're
I'm sick again. Yeah.
And you're trying to run the show. And, of course, they don't want you to run the show. They want to run it. But this is your life. And the other thing is that we're in a race against time, because the longer that this is going on in you, the sicker that you're. Yeah, the sicker that you're getting.
Yeah, I'm wearing down. There's no question. And when
and
I look at my blood
work. And then
will
you be able to withstand the surgery? Like the doctor you talked to this morning, he's talking like 3 weeks from now.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 3 weeks. We need to have gotten this out 3 weeks ago.
Well, the one I was talking to this morning would like to do 6 weeks, not 3 weeks.
He wants to give you lots of antibiotics.
He wants to give you the antibiotics.
Oh, here's another thing. I just as an aside about the antibiotics, because they want him to have the antibiotics in an IV.
Mm-hmm.
That's an intravenous. IV. Okay, I'm an RN. I have an active license, but I'm not allowed to do it. He would have to go to the clinic every single day and have them infuse it because insurance would not cover it to the tune of $5,000 or more if I did it.
Yeah, well, you're right.
So that's our crazy system. But anyway, I think everybody gets the idea. If anybody has any suggestions, let us know.
Well, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we have a call from Mike from Michigan. Mike, you there?
Hi, can you hear me?
Perfectly. How are you?
Yes, I'm great. I listen to Dr. Robinson a lot, the ozone guy.
Uh-huh.
I think ozone would benefit you a lot because
I think you're right.
It detoxes and then it kills everything.
You're right. And so it's something I want to consider along with IV vitamin C, I think would be another great way to go. And believe it or not, Mike, I have another set of doctors that I haven't discussed with my mainstream doctors who are orthomolecular doctors who know a lot about this stuff. And I think that that's probably something to consider. The problem with doing things like that is that you burn bridges with the mainstream because as soon as you've done that, they don't want any part of you. And I know I need a surgery. No question about that.
You don't want somebody operating on you that doesn't
that's
like
mad at you.
Or this.
Yeah. And so I'm in a place now where I have to decide which way I'm going to go. And the ozone is very appealing. There's some people out here who do it that are wonderful. Robert Rowan's here. Frank Schallenberger's here. Richard Gracier's here. All people who are experts in ozone therapy and so much more. So thanks for that. You've got a great suggestion there, and I'm thinking about that. So thanks for calling, Mike. Okay. If anybody else has suggestions or they have ideas or stories that they'd like to share about themselves that maybe they've gone through where they found that they had an impossible time trying to work with doctors in an open environment where we're discussing things in a forum and people are invited from different disciplines to participate, both mainstream and complementary and alternative, it would be great to hear your story. So give us a call. The number again is 888-874-4888.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned was about C. difficile, and there was a study
that just came out recently.
And, you know, we've been about C. difficile, and we've been discouraging these proton pump inhibitors and the H2 blockers that are prescribed so often for acid reflux disease and for heartburn and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking about this on the radio for a long time in favor of safer alternative solutions. But, you know, it's tough to be contrary to the marketing of big pharma. And the latest evidence now shows that the purple pill-like drugs increase the risk of C. difficile by 3 times if taken for only a month.
Yeah.
Now, C.
Just
difficile
for 1 month. That's
is
right.
A really serious, life-threatening
people die from it. That's right.
Form of diarrhea, and it's resistant to antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
So this is pretty serious business we're talking
about.
Well,
and not to mention all the other things that these purple pills do. I mean, you're talking about they knock out your acid production. How in the world are you going to digest your food? And how are you going to absorb things that require acid, things like iron, calcium, magnesium, and B12? You won't. And look at the fact that the risk for osteoporosis after a few years of treatment goes up 45%, and the risk of senile dementia goes up about 18%, and that you can have problems with heart rhythm disturbances that can be a real challenge. And you can have an increased risk of pneumonia in the hospital if you're on these things.
And they can change the flora of the intestine like antibiotics do.
Oh, for sure.
The other thing is that they're kind of addicting because you have this thing called rebound dyspepsia. Mm-hmm. Maybe you'd like to talk about what that is.
Yeah, well, when you take this these purple pills for about 8 weeks, 40% of people, when they stop it, will have an overproduction of acid that will cause symptoms and drive you back to taking your purple pill for maybe forever. Anyway, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's first 2020 health tip.
time my 2020 tip isn't going to be so funny. I want to talk about how lobbyists are spinning weak science to defend bisphenol A, or BPA, that is the way we often refer to it. It's a synthetic chemical, and it's used to make polycarbonate plastics and the epoxy resins that line food and beverage cans. And also, they even use them in thermal receipt papers, mm-hmm. you know, when they give you a receipt.
It's amazing. And even money has
it. Yeah, money. We were talking about that not long ago.
You can't get away from BPA.
Anyway, the Breast Cancer Fund, that's a nonprofit organization, released the results of its testing for BPA in the canned foods that are marketed to children. And they found that there's BPA in Campbell's Disney Princess Cool Shapes, the Toy Story Fun Shakes pasta and chicken broth, SpaghettiOs with meatballs, Earth Best Organic Elmo Noodle Mania Soup, Chef Boyardee Whole Grain Pasta Mini ABCs and 1-2-3s with meatballs, and Annie's Homegrown Organic Cheesy Raviolis. And these are at high levels.
Yeah.
And they've been shown to be biologically active, meaning that they're high enough to interact with and affect our cells. So the North American Metal Packaging Alliance, also called NAMPA, a trade association, and it represents the food and beverage metal packaging industry, they fired off this press release citing that there's no health risk from BPA exposure through canned foods.
Oh, this is based on their vast experience, right?
So this misrepresentation has outraged, you know, the scientific community. And NAMPA says, you know, it's not a health risk, and they go on and on about that. But anyway, their study doesn't show anything of the kind, because no children were included in the study, and the researchers didn't even measure how much BPA was in the food that the people that were in the studies ate.
Well, how many people were in the study?
Only about 20.
20 people? And that's a study?
Yeah. Anyway, so BPA is an endocrine-disrupting chemical, and it's been linked to numerous adverse impacts on developmental, metabolic, reproductive, neurological, cardiovascular, and other systems.
Cancer. That's right.
And childhood exposure is a concern, because early life exposure to endocrine-disrupting chemicals can set the stage for later health disorders like diabetes, even obesity, and then certain cancers like you just mentioned. So there's a concern over these effects that have led 10 U.S. But I want you to listen to this carefully, because I'm getting to a point here. There's been a concern over these effects, and they've led to 10 U.S. states and several local governments to bar the BPA from children's reusable food and beverage containers. And they've prompted major manufacturers of baby bottles and toddler sippy cups to switch to alternative materials. And Canada has added BPA to its list of toxic substances. And Japan took BPA out of their can linings in the 1990s. And China and Malaysia have now instituted bans on BPA in baby bottles. But the U.S. federal government does not bar the use of BPA in these products.
Well, what you have to understand, Vicki, is that healthcare is a business, and it's about return on investment. It's not about service. It's the only way you could possibly put together a scenario that we spend $2.5 trillion a year now, which is more than twice of any other industrialized country, and we're still ranked 37th in the world in overall quality of healthcare. Now, to do that, service can't possibly be the primary thing. It has to be about generating the economy. It's an economic stimulus package. And that's how you can throw dollars at healthcare and do silly things like this. And what you do is make more people sick. You have more healthcare costs. You need more in the way of big pharma, more in the way of the insurance industry, more doctors, et cetera, et cetera. Costs go up. Quality of care is a big issue. And how we feel goes way down.
So anyway, the FDA does say that they support a shift towards stronger regulation of BPA, and they support the efforts to find safer alternatives to BPA for infant formula mm-hmm. and for other food and beverage can liners. So they say it, but they haven't done it. And the chemical industry, this NAMPA and some of the other industry groups, they've just consistently defended the safety of the BPA, and they've lobbied extensively against its regulation. And so they're just misrepresenting this whole situation, and the scientific community is upset. And NAMPA didn't measure, you know, like I said earlier, they didn't measure how much BPA was in the food that these 20 people ate, and they didn't even use any kids, so it's impossible to tell how much the BPA measured in their blood and their urine, you know, from the meals that they ate during the study. So it was flawed. And in 2010, the American Cancer Council spent millions of dollars on lobbying to defeat legislation that would restrict the use of BPA. Yeah, so anyway, it's just a shame that money in politics overrules our health and that of our children. But just know that knowledge is power, and our pocketbooks vote. So make healthy choices. Go for fresh food. Try to stay away from canned foods if you can.
I have some advice for these people who are putting BPA in their products. Buy a pair of tap dancing shoes, because when you get to the pearly gates, I think you're going to need them. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Primary care physicians admit in a large survey that they practice medicine too aggressively with tests and therapy and hospitalizations, mostly because of malpractice concerns and too little time with their patients, and they see no recourse. So do you see a solution to our healthcare system the way this is?
Well, I mean, no, not the way it's set up. Because doctors unwittingly gave away their control over how medicine is practiced in about the year 1990, when HMO medicine came along and very cleverly bought their practices, to the point where there are very few doctors who now are in private practice who can determine what they do fully, as opposed to people who are in these giant HMOs that have bosses that tell them what they can and can't do. And if they don't follow the protocols exactly as they are, and if they don't have clinical performance measures that are high enough, they're simply let go. Doctor, you're not a very good doctor. You're not following these rules well. We're going to have to let you go. Now, isn't that amazing? How unwitting were we back in the early 90s when the hospitals came to us and said, we'll give you $300,000 to $500,000 for your practice, and for 5 years, you could still own and do your practice, but after that, we'll own the practice and you can work for us. So many doctors did that, in part because they didn't want to be left out of that, and in part because they wanted the money. And here we are today with a system that is not built on service, it's built on economics. When you look at hospitals, insurance companies, and any other service organizations, they're all about return on investment. If you're in a hospital board meeting, you'd vomit at the way the discussions are going about how are we going to be financially solvent? How are we going to provide services but so we can make profit on top of it as well?
Well, just like we were joking about a week or so ago, you went and had some tests done, and we were calling it the money machine.
Oh, it's a money factory. Instead of, you know, when I had my joint aspirated, all you do is you stick a needle in the joint, you aspirate back, and you send the fluid to the lab and you culture it. It's easy to do. But now they have a center that does that. So you make an appointment, you come in, you talk to the girls, they ask you if you want something to drink, they usher you to a little room where they put you in a gown, they start an IV, and somebody nice comes up to you and says something about, would you like to have a little sedation? And what they're talking about is a light general anesthetic.
Oh, that's right. We talked about that, didn't we, last
week? We did, but that's what's happening. And then finally, we wind up in getting the procedure done by a physician who specializes in that. Now, 10 years ago, when I had gone to my orthopedist, he'd have put the needle in and out. He would have taken the fluid and sent it off for $150. I'll bet you this bill's $5,000.
Can you imagine all the people that are employed in this money machine, though? There are a lot of people that are employed there.
Absolutely. All right, we have a few calls waiting, so I want to take them. The number here is 888-874-4888. I'm Dr. Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and we have a call from Sandy from Florida. Hi, Sandy, you there?
Hi, Len.
How are you?
Good. How about you?
Well, I've been better, but thank you.
I'm sorry to hear about all that. I have a question here. What would be an alternative to antibiotic? Because I have a problem with the antibiotics. My skin peels because I have an overgrowth of candida. And I was wondering if colloidal silver is something that you would recommend.
Well, it's just another antibiotic choice. I don't look at it any different than I would penicillin or erythromycin or tetracycline. They do the same kind of thing. They may spare some of the normal flora a bit more than antibiotics do. That's supposed to be their big thing. But in general, people who have problems like that should talk to Vicky, because it's a lot of the skincare products that we put on our bodies that cause things like this to happen. So, Vicky, where can people get information about this?
Well, on drsaputo.com, just click on Vicky's Corner.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot about it, but she said that hers is more like an allergy, it sounds
Well, that's the very thing that a lot of your safe skincare products are about. See, Sandy, Vicky almost died about 20 years ago because of lots of things she was sensitive to that we couldn't find in regular Western medicine testing. And when we finally identified the 41 things that she was sensitive to, a lot of them were skincare products. And so,
I've spent about 20 years researching healthy skincare products. And when I got over my allergies, I thought, well, why would I want to use products that are toxic anyway, you know? So the ones that I recommend on our site, they're all natural and organic and I like the way they go on and that kind of thing.
So Vicky's tried all these and they're time tested. And I've had so many patients who come to me because they have eczema or their skin is peeling and they think they have candida or some other problem. They go off everything that they put in their on their skin, except for the products on Vicky's list. And by the way, the list is free. So if you go to Vicky's Corner and drsaputo.com, it's all free, and you'll know what to do there. So
I don't really put anything on my skin. It's just when I take antibiotics that this happens to me.
Well, it may be that the antibiotics are causing it then. So why?
And I've talked to my doctor about it, but they don't seem to be concerned. So I just stop going to the doctors, you know, and I try to treat myself with colloidal silver or whatever. And
yeah, does it work?
If there was something out there that
does the colloidal silver work?
Colloidal silver work for you?
In somewhat it does. I make my own now. I don't buy it from the store. And I also have a device that I'm starting to use. It's a Bob Beck device. You know, I'm going to see if that helps.
A lot of the time what I find is that these kinds of allergic reactions are they're built up. You may have an allergy to a soap, another one to some kind of lipstick you're using, another to
shampoos
or something that's in the air. And then you get over a certain point and all hell breaks loose. So what you want to do is be a detective and go back and only expose yourself to those things that you know are safe.
I usually start with
skincare products.
What is it that you get infections to that you think you need antibiotics?
When I get really sick and I get these migraines and sinus infections, that's what they were treating me with, the antibiotics.
Oh, dear.
You know, that makes the condition worse, actually.
Yeah, I wouldn't use antibiotics for that. You have a problem with your neck, don't you, Sandy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what the problem is what you need is, if you can find it, is some infrared light therapy to your neck, and there's a very good chance the headaches will disappear. And even what you think is a sinus infection is probably referred pain from the back of the neck to the sinuses. It's shocking. I've been using infrared light for about 12 years and have found it to be magical for things like that.
And sometimes chiropractic will help, too.
Chiropractic is great for it. The light is really good, especially in combination with that. So that's what I suggest you think about, Sandy.
Okay.
So thanks for calling.
Maybe a neti pot for your sinus infections.
Yeah, okay. Have a great day. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. The number is 415-543-TALK. It looks like it's time for a station break. It was that for some time ago. So let's take that station break. We've got some calls waiting, and we'll get right back to them then. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health, and I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicky. The number, if you have a question for us, is 888-874-4888, and we have a call from Jeff from L.A. Hi, Jeff, you there?
Hello.
How are you?
Hey.
Good.
I'm suffering a bit from hepatitis C, and I was considering ozone therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the L.A. area. Do you know practitioners down here that do ozone therapy for hepatitis patients?
A really good place to go would be to go to Julian Whitaker's clinic down there. It's Julian, Whitaker.
Oh, yeah, I've seen him on TVN many times.
Yes, he would be fantastic. And even if they didn't do the procedure there, which would surprise me a lot, he could refer you to someone that could. So that's a good choice.
Yeah, he's quite far. He's in Hermosa Beach or Manhattan Beach.
Then give him a call. Call his clinic and say, who do you recommend out here? Because then you'll be getting it from somebody who's local, who's a genius, really has high-quality health care, and can guide you probably the best.
McCall.
So thanks for calling, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for your advice.
Have a great day. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We have a call from Harvey. How you doing, Harvey?
Hi, Dr. Lynn and Nurse Vicki. How are you?
Hey,
fine.
Harvey.
What's up?
Great. Well, I remember I told you that I took sugar out of my diet, but I've taken three other things out of my diet, and I want to report that I feel incredibly great. So now I don't eat anything with sugar. And by the way, if you they hide sugar under 100 names. So if you Google the words names of sugar, you can click on it, and then there's one website that has 50 names they put sugar under. Another website, there's 100 names that sugar is put under. So it's good to read those names, and so when you read packages, you'll know that that's sugar. The other ones are white flour, white rice, and corn products. Now, I do eat corn on the cob, and I do eat brown rice because I feel that they have nutrition, but I won't eat corn products, white rice, and white flour, and sugar. So,
well, these are all simple carbohydrates, which are all sugar, aren't they?
That's right. And my friend, he sort of made an interesting point. He said that, you know, when I eat foods that are more, not acid, but what's the other thing?
Alkaline.
When I eat foods that are more alkaline, and they generally have more nutrition, like vegetables and greens and so on and so forth. So I keep on a high alkaline, nutritious diet, and I stay away from the foods that give me energy. So I'm getting a lot of nutrition, but very little energy. And so what happens is, because I'm not eating the flour, the sugar, the white rice, and the corn products, my body taps my own fat for energy. It sort of cracks it because it needs it, and so I lose weight. So that's what weight reduction is all about. If you have a strong nutritional system and not much foods that give you energy, then your body will use your own energy. And so that's how I've gotten. And I also got rid of a serious rash I used to have. I don't know now which ones of the things that cause it, either the flour, the rice, or the corn products, but I don't have any digestive problems. I never have any, you know, acidic feeling. I feel young. I feel very flexible, and I'm thin, and I feel good. So I feel, once again, sugar, white rice, white flour, and corn products, those are the killers, and those are the ones that lead to all the diseases that we know of.
Well, so congratulations for taking responsibility for your health.
Well, I feel great, and I'm conducting the experiment on myself, so it's not something I read. I mean, I live it every day, and I save a terrific amount of money. And with the money I save, because I'm not buying all these pre-prepared foods, I buy organic, everything organic as much as possible, and so I'm avoiding the pesticides, fungicides, fumicides, and fertilizers that way as well. So that's it.
Harvey, we're going to make you the poster boy of this show.
Well,
you're doing great work, and we appreciate the call. All right, have a great day. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. Oh, it's time for your tip. That's what you're trying to tell me. Yeah, we've been carried away here. So you know the number, you know the show. We'll be back after Vicki's final 2020 health tip.
What a some things for you to remember for a peace of mind to avoid dis-ease from one of our listeners, Mike. Life isn't fair, but it can still be good. You don't have to win every argument. You can agree to disagree. Cry with someone. It's more healing than crying alone. And it's okay to get angry with God because he can take it. Make peace with your past so it won't screw up the present. Isn't that the truth?
Yep.
And it's okay to let your children see you cry. I remember the first time my son saw me cry.
You remember where it was?
I remember everything about it.
Mm.
It was the first time he told me he loved me.
Wow.
So I decided that was okay.
So you do it all the time now.
No. Don't compare your life to others. You have no idea what their journey's all about.
That's true.
And if a relationship has to be a secret, you most likely shouldn't be in it.
That's true.
You can get through anything if you stay put in today. In other words, to be present.
That's right.
Over-prepare, and then you can just go with the flow. And no one's in charge of your happiness except for you. And however good or bad a situation is, it'll change. And whatever doesn't kill you really does make you stronger. Your children only get one childhood, so make it memorable in a good way.
That's good stuff.
And if we all threw our problems in a pile and saw everyone else's, we'd probably just grab ours back. Get rid of anything that isn't useful, beautiful, or joyful. And if you don't ask, you don't get. Life isn't tied with a bow, but it's still a gift.
Isn't that so true? That's great advice and beautiful things to listen to. Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks, Mike.
Yeah, you know, earlier we were talking about how doctors tend to over-treat people. And we talked about their malpractice concerns because they don't do all the things that they that the modern local doctors do. They're going to be at risk for the disapproval of the doctors, of the medical community, and of the medical board. If you want to take some aggressive stances yourself that involve not using a lot of therapies, a lot of drugs and surgeries or whatever, you can do that so long as your patient doesn't suffer from it. That's legal. But you certainly put yourself at risk for the kinds of things that you don't want to be exposed to, which is the wrath of your peers and your medical board. Then the other thing that's a big issue is the HMOs are really measuring clinical performance on the basis of what return on investment is about. We touched on that earlier. But it's really an important point to make, and so I want to make sure you hear it. And the last thing that leads doctors to do too many things is to cover the bases when they don't have enough time. They're apt to do more things to play CYA, which is called cover your ass, by doing more in the way of tests. In fact, doctors believe they're paid to do more and they're exposed to legal punishment if they do less. And it's quite right. So many doctors are now recognizing the excesses that we're doing in current practice, but they're really, as I said, because of how medicine has gone in the early 1990s over to HMO medicine, where the doctor now is only a intermediary person who is following the advice, recommendations, laws, rules of the HMO, not what they think is necessary to the best medicine. And a lot of the times when they overrule things because they know it's ridiculous, particularly when there's a patient in the emergency room that should be in the hospital, but there's no way to cover it. So they say, don't admit. And you admit anyway, probably going to lose your job. So what we have is the bureaucrats, the bean counters, making medical decisions when they don't know really the first thing about them because they're not trained physicians.
Because, again, it's just all about money.
Putting doctors in a place that's not right. That was our fault back in the 1990s when we saw that coming. I remember giving a talk at Grand Rounds at my hospital where I talked about all this. I said, this is what's coming. And they all cheered and thought it was wonderful stuff and said, you're right. But every single one of them, every single one of them now works for some kind of health maintenance organization. There is nobody that I know of besides myself that's in private practice in our community that was in that group at that time. It's a sad scenario where we've lost the control of the practice of medicine when we are the very people who should have a lot to say about what kinds of medical decisions are made. And it's not like we make always the wisest decisions. I mean, you heard me talk this morning as I was talking about my own care. And one doctor says one thing and another doctor says another thing. And I'm in a position where I'm trying to say, can't you guys get it together? Do we need to go to complementary and alternative approaches for this too? That would be the absolute end of my relationship with my colleagues in mainstream medicine if I start doing things like IV ozone, which I think would be a great thing to do in this setting, or IV vitamin C, or other kinds of minerals and nutrients and vitamins that perhaps are in greater demand because I'm sick right now. And where am I getting them from? Even if it's in my diet, if my intestinal tract isn't able to digest and absorb them, it doesn't matter. They're not going to get into the body, and I'll have deficiencies. And when you're sick and you have problems with the gut and you have the so-called leaky gut syndrome, we're always at a compromised position that makes it difficult for us to get the raw materials we need for our bodies to be able to make the products that they need, that it needs to make to keep us healthy. So we're in a big dilemma here with a dysfunctional system that doesn't work together. We're more in a war with each other than we are in a situation where we're trying to work together peacefully to try and create a better healthcare system. Because let's face it, 50% of America has a chronic disease. There's room for better approaches to make these diseases disappear. And there is no single discipline that's been able to solve the problem because it hasn't. So wouldn't the next logical step be, gee, let's see if we can work with Chinese medicine, maybe with Ayurveda, Native American medicine, some of the complementary and alternative therapies and energy medicine, along with the mainstream doctors? Shouldn't these people be invited into the hospitals to add their say to what might be helpful when we doctors haven't got a clue about a lot of it, such as nutrition and such as energy medicine, or okay, even the traditional Eastern medicines?
Well, what about public health and prevention? You know, those are
another good
often
thing
omitted from physician training, and now the Association of American Medical Colleges and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say that they're committed to strengthening collaborations between academic medicine and public health.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a no-brainer. We know that. But see, logic isn't what runs medicine. What runs medicine is return on investment. It's the same old thing. And who do you think is teaching doctors in medical schools what they learn? It's the people with the money who are, quote, donating it to the medical centers so that they can allow medical students to be taught. But they want to be taught what? Their stuff. So you wind up with Big Pharma funding a lot of the research that's done in medical centers and having a huge impact on what the curriculum is in its detail that's taught to medical students. So what do you expect will happen? As long as the system is like it is, there is no way for it to heal. We need a new system that's based on wellness and prevention and nutrition and natural therapies, on lifestyle factors, all those things we all know we need. But we get outraged by the fact that we don't have it, but we don't spend our money wisely so that we just support that by buying products that are the right products to buy that support that. We just go on assuming that life is the way it is, and that the FDA, the CDC, the insurance industry, Big Pharma, medical research, and medical training are all just fine. It's why I wrote my book, A Return to Healing, because it talks about this in great detail. And by the way, it was voted the Gold Award for the best book in health and healing for the year 2010. So for those of you that haven't seen or read the book, it's called A Return to Healing. Go to Amazon and take a look at it. It's a book that I highly recommend because you learn the answers to why things are exactly like they are. Yeah, you could also go to drsaputo.com, where you can buy the book, actually at a discounted price. So I'm just trying to be fair about different ways to get it. So, again, that's drsaputo.com.
You know, too, speaking of health insurance, you know, all the discussion that we had about the cost of health insurance during the last election, it didn't have any beneficial effect in lowering health care premiums. I mean,
no, it was a lot of talk, a lot of promises, a lot of we should do this because it's right. But when push came to shove,
they didn't lower the cost of insurance. They actually raised it.
Well, the insurance industry now is making more money than it did 2 years ago. And they're raising premiums. And they can do what they want. There are a few things that were imposed on them, but they didn't. The insurance industry didn't really care because you just raised your rates again. And it gets more expensive. So it means that fewer people are going to be insured, and probably only about half of America is insured with adequate insurance. The other 50% are underinsured or have no insurance at all. Isn't that a tragedy for a country like this that spends $2.5 trillion a year to be in that scenario?
So all that was a bunch of talk. Anyway, you know, we promised we were going to talk about this vitamin that was tied to brain atrophy and cognitive impairment.
All right.
There's a new study that provides more evidence that poor vitamin B12 status is a risk factor for brain atrophy and cognitive impairment. And it highlights the importance of vitamin B12 metabolites that are not routinely assessed. So this sounds like an easy way to treat the elderly that have cognitive impairment.
It
just
might
check
be.
For B12 and then supplement it. But tell us about the B12 markers.
Okay, well, let's look at it this way. First of all, B12 is getting a bad rap because it's a vitamin. Right? And doctors don't care about vitamins for the most part. And you measure a level of B12 and it's in the normal range, and you assume that there's plenty of B12 to do all the jobs that B12 does. Turns out it's not true. And so you have to measure some of the markers of B12 metabolism, like methylmalonic acid and homocysteine and a couple of others, that will give you a good idea if the body is being nourished with enough B12 for energy production, red cell production, for cognitive function, for total brain volume, for the regulation of cancer, and for immunity. Now, you show me a doctor who understands all these aspects of B12, and I'll fall over in a pile.
So, in other words, you need to be tested for the homocysteine and some of these other things.
Yeah, methylmalonic acid. Those should be routine tests that are done on everybody over the age of 65. Because these are the people who are having so much trouble with these brain findings, you know, with global cognitive scores that are dropping.
And we seem to have an awful lot of that going around.
Well, yeah, and if you know something that can help to prevent that, why not? And it's not a surprise to me that you see B12 in the normal range, but not its metabolites. When its metabolites are not where they should be, it's telling you that it's not, that there's not enough metabolism going on in certain areas to protect against these other things we're talking about. So I think that these are the kinds of things that we should be listening to. I mean, they're in the mainstream medical literature. I think this particular article came out in a journal called Neurology.
And if you do need B12, the best way to get it is either to let it dissolve under your tongue or to get it in an injection.
Well, you almost have to have it in an injection if these things are off. And the form that should be used is hydroxycobalamin, not the others, because it's pure and it actually has, it protects against certain kind of problems you can get into if you use the other forms. So it's not like this is a straightforward, simple, slam-dunk situation. You have to know what's going on with B12 metabolism by measuring the related markers that will uncover some of the areas where you don't have enough in the way of information, which is the serum B12 level.
Well, there's another article that I wanted to talk about, and maybe we're running out of time.
Yeah, we're running out of time. You're right.
So do you want me to say?
Well, just real quickly, what did you have in mind?
Well, I don't know if I can do it quick. It had to do with mammogram marketing.
No, I think that one we're going to cover next week. That's a biggie. I mean, women feel so secure about getting mammograms, and they're convinced that they do when they've done good. Well, it depends on who you are, what age you are, what risk factors you have for developing cancer. And all these things are factors that if we don't look at, we can't go around saying you should have a mammogram, you shouldn't have a mammogram.
But most women most women believe that they're vital to their health.
That's a huge misconception.
89% of women believe that.
I would say if you overdo the mammogram, particularly in women under the age of 50, that you're doing malpractice and a disservice if you do it across the board. Because you're going to discover too many cancers that aren't, meaning the DCISs, of which 2% will kill you and the other 98% will just be there. But the doctors are going to treat 100% of them with radiation, surgery, and chemotherapy if they have their way. So
in other words, mammogram marketing has been successful to a fault.
Exactly. And why are we the only country in the world that does it for women under the age of 50? Come on, tell me that one. Anyway, thank you all for being here and listening to our show. We'd like to remind you that we'll be back live to talk about what's new in the news and health and take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.com and DrSabuto.com from 3 to 4 Eastern Time and 12 to 1 Pacific Time. They're also archived on DrSabuto.com, which is a site I highly recommend you visit.
So remember, life's about the most powerful healer in the world. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.